Raina Grande is the author of two novels, Across 100 Mountains, which won the American Book Award, and Dancing with Butterflies. The Distance Between Us, which is nonfiction, came out in 2012. Raina Grande, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You lost your parents by turns. Tell us about how old you were and the process by which they left you behind.
Yeah, my father was the first one to leave. I was 2 years old when he came to the U.S. to look for work, because Mexico at the time was going through a recession and there were no jobs, no opportunities. And that's when people started migrating here. This was in the late 70s. So my father left first. And then a few years later, when I was 4 and a half, he called my mother and said, I want you to come and help me make money. So then my mother came here to the U.S. and my siblings and I were left behind with my grandmother, my father's mother. So they left, you know, separately, but in the end we ended up not having a mother or a father for many years.
When your mom finally came back, she had some surprises. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, when my mother came back a few years later, she showed up to our grandma's house with the little baby in her arms. And that was really hard for me because I was the youngest in the family. And then my mother shows up with a new child that she had given birth to in the U.S. And I felt so inferior to this little girl because, you know, she was made in the USA and I was Mexican. And I felt resentful of this little girl who had come to replace me as the youngest. And also another surprise for my mother was that my father had left her for another woman. So to me, it was really heartbreaking to realize that the family that I had in Mexico no longer existed, because now my parents had split up and my father remarried and eventually my mother also remarried. So we never really got that family back that we once had. And to me, that's the biggest irony of our immigrant experience, because both of my parents left to save the family, to give us something better, give us a better life. But in the process of migrating, they ended up destroying our family.
The way that people speak about the United States in your part of Mexico or did at the time, it's always referred to as el otro lado, the other side. I mean, how ominous was it to you being as little as you were?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, the concept of the U.S. and el otro lado, I compare it to a story of La Llorona, which is the weeping woman that roams the canals and the rivers and steals children. And this is a myth of this woman who drowned her own children, and she was condemned to spend the rest of eternity searching for the souls of the children that she drowned. So over there, whenever, you know, children don't behave, you get threatened that La Llorona is going to come take you away if you don't behave. And so to me, when I thought of the United States, I compared it to that image of La Llorona, because La Llorona takes away children, but the United States takes away parents.
Crossing the border broke your family ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a sad story. How old were you when you came to the United States, Raina?
I was 9 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It was in May, actually. This month I'm celebrating my 31st anniversary in the U.S.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Are you a citizen now?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. How difficult a process was that?
Well, my family was very lucky because my parents were already here in the late 70s, they got here. So then when I arrived in 1985, a year later, there was an amnesty, you know, the amnesty of 86 that has now gotten a pretty bad reputation, but it allowed 3 million people to legalize their status, and both of my parents were able to become legal residents because of the amnesty. So then by 1990, the whole family had papers, and so we got our green cards because of that. So we were very lucky that we came around that time, because ever since the amnesty, we haven't really had any immigration reform. And all the immigrants that have come after that, they haven't really had any opportunities to legalize their status.
as you point out, amnesty has become something of a dirty word on the right wing in America. What has that been like for you as a person who's been a beneficiary of previous American largesse to watch this process where we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, it passes one house in Congress, the other one stops it, and then immediately it becomes something that no one will touch with a 10-foot pole?
Right. Well, to me, it's a real shame, you know, that amnesty has become such a dirty word, because we forget, you know, what it really means and what it has done to a population that was kept in the shadows. And because of this amnesty, this forgiveness, we were able to step out of the shadows and to be able to reach our full potential and to be able to contribute back to this country because of that opportunity. And to me, like, it's a shame that we blame the amnesty for what happened after that in terms of immigration, because it wasn't so much the amnesty part that didn't work, but it was the other two components of that, which was the employer sanctions and the border security that didn't work because they were not upheld. And yet it's the amnesty part of the bill that gets blamed. But I would like for people to take a closer look at what really happened back then, and to understand that it wasn't that we gave amnesty that caused this broken immigration.
So you're saying the other parts weren't upheld? They weren't enforced? The employer sanctions?
They were not.
And border security, sure.
From Reina Grande, we go to the views of Dr. Dan Tichenor, an immigration scholar at the University of Oregon. Here's what he had to say in September about the lasting impact of the immigration reforms Reina Grande experienced in 1986.
You know, one of the real challenges basically since the last time we did significant reform in this area, which was in 86, has been a lot of cynicism about the fact that last time we did this, there was a sense that legalization was going to be a one-time only reform, and that employer sanctions as passed in 86 were said to be, you know, the solution. It ended up being a toothless tiger. And so as a result, I think two things are really striking about where most Americans stand on this, according to polling. The first is that most actually have more faith or more support for extending some kind of legalization to the 10 to 14 million undocumented immigrants in the country right now. And that's very different from 86, where the vast majority of Americans opposed any kind of legalization program. So we've seen a real shift in that area. But at the same time, the same polls show that most Americans are deeply cynical about the will and capacity of the government to control its borders.
Dr. Dan Tichenor is the Philip Knight Chair of Political Science at the University of Oregon. He's the author of Dividing Lines, The Politics of Immigration Control in America, and an editor of the Oxford Handbook of the Politics of International Migration.
History can't tell us how the new president's administration will approach immigration and border security. We visited with Medford-based immigration attorney John Almaguer in June after a Supreme Court decision blocked one of the Obama administration's key policies.
Help us understand the couple of different threads that have been moving through the courts and through administrative action of late. There's the DACA, Delayed Action on Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, and there's the DAPA, or DAPA. And what's that?
Okay, DAPA, I was surprised because when it first came out, it was announced as Deferred Action for Parental Accountability, which I never quite understood what that meant. Now they're saying DAPA stands for Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, American Citizens, and LPRs, Lawful Permanent Residents. So how they get DAPA out of that, I'm not quite sure, but that's now the official title.
So what was the effect of the recent Supreme Court non-decision? It left a ruling from a Texas case in place, correct?
It left the preliminary injunction in place. So it's going to go back to Texas. And then the case gets decided on the merits of the case and not just on the preliminary injunction. So this may very well come back to the Supreme Court once we have a full court. So it's the preliminary injunction is what has been held in place. So what is the impact? Really, other than shattered expectations, on the practical points, not much, because these programs, the DAPA had never been implemented. DACA, the childhood arrivals, that was going to be an expansion of the program from the 2012 original executive action. So what that means is that the expansion of DACA never went into place. What was the expansion going to be? It was going to you had to show that you were here in the United States before June 7th or by June 15th, 2007. They're going to move that up to January 1st, 2010. It was going to be moved from a two-year grant of deferred action to three-year grant. And they were going to remove an age restriction because you had to be under 31 as of June 15th, 2012. So they were going to remove that. So technically, me with my gray hairs, had I come into the United States before I was 16 years old and I did comply with all the other requirements, I could have been eligible for deferred action under childhood arrivals. So so this is what got stopped. But the initial program is still in place, and we still have a lot of people who are otherwise eligible for it who are barely turning 15, because in essence, this is a work authorization. So we don't want kids under 15 to be working for obvious reasons. So as they're turning 15 and they were here from June 2007, we're still putting in applications for initial DACA for these kids.
Does anybody really know? I mean, the figure that gets bandied about the people who potentially could face deportation, anywhere between 11 and 12 million. Of that number, and you can tell me if you agree with it or not, but of that number, do we have any idea how many are children who were brought here not of their own power from outside the country?
The statistic on children, quite honestly, I don't have at hand. What I did see in preparation for this today, that there's about 5 million parents of lawful permanent resident or U.S. citizen children. So you're looking at about nearly half of the undocumented population being having ties to the United States. So when you have politicians talking about deporting 11 to 12 million undocumented people, what a lot of people don't understand is it's not undocumented people stay amongst themselves. They've become part of the social fabric of this country. So you're destroying American families when you're deporting 12 million undocumented people.
Well, once people understand all the points you make, there's the standard reaction, I think, which is, you know, but these people came here illegally and they're asking the federal government to forgive them.
Well, up until fairly recently in U.S. history, there was no illegal way to come into the United States. So quite honestly, the way that people have come into the United States was not much different from the way people had come in the past. The rules changed. So the first waves of immigrants saying we did it the right way, there was no wrong way of doing it. So you were only denied if you were insane or a pauper. And so those were your two restrictions. So if we still had those restrictions today, I think we wouldn't have the problems we have today.
But those are old immigration. We're talking like pre-1920 immigration law, right?
Yes, yeah. And so we're talking about the shifts in immigration happening in, around the turn of the century where they started becoming stricter. But still, when people take the grandstand and they say, you know, we did it right, once again, there was no wrong way of doing it.
John Almaguer is an immigration attorney based in Medford. You're listening to a review of immigration-related conversations we've had on The Exchange over the last year. Up next, the history of an island to welcome or exclude future Americans until it closed down in 1940.
The story of Ellis Island in New York Harbor is well known. It was the entry point to the United States for millions of immigrants. Much less well known is the story of Angel Island in San Francisco Bay. It, too, played a role in immigration, though not nearly the generally sunny role Ellis Island played in so many lives. The immigration station on Angel Island closed years ago and fell into disrepair. Now it has been spruced up for visitors to learn of the history of American immigration and exclusion. Grant Dinn is with the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation, AIISF, where he's the Community Relations Director and our guest on The Exchange. Grant, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good to have you here today.
Happy to be here.
Give us a quick history lesson. How did Angel Island function in the immigration system?
Well, for 30 years, between 1910 and 1940, it was the point at which a lot of immigrants from across the Pacific were interviewed. Many of them were questioned on their ship, and if their papers were in order, were generally sent on their way in San Francisco. But for a lot of them, especially those from Asia, they had to go through a whole series of questioning because of laws like the Chinese Exclusion Act, which kept out all Chinese who were laborers and only allowed those who were merchants, students, diplomats, educators, and the like. Others who came through were sons and daughters of those who were already here or claimed they were already here. If they were born here, their parents would be citizens.
So was Angel Island a bit more of a place of sorrow, perhaps, than Ellis Island ever was?
Yes. For many of those who came through, they were questioned to verify that they were actually the sons and daughters of who they said they were. And the government developed a very extensive set of questioning. For example, they would say, and I ask your listeners to think if they know these answers for their own house, who lives in the third house of the fourth row of your community? How many windows are in your house? Where in your house is the rice bin kept? Things like that. They would ask these questions of the alleged child and alleged father, usually the father. If their answers did not match, they would think that they were really not their son or daughter and often schedule them for deportation. And so people would appeal their cases, and they'd hire local attorneys from San Francisco. And during the time that their cases were in appeal, they would just wait and have not much to do. And a lot of them would carve poems into the walls of the building, and that's where the stories have become known, and that's why the buildings were saved, because there are hundreds of poems all over the walls, tales of sorrow and frustration and anger at their own government for being weak so they couldn't stay in this country, and so on. And a lot of them have been, pretty much all of them have been translated and published.
So I want to understand, there was a detention center of sorts at Angel Island?
Yeah, in many ways it was, because people would come through and they would be kept. Usually people would stay only maybe a few days or up to a week or two, but if their cases were questioned, they would stay for as long as a few months and even as long as a couple years for some men and women that we've documented.
So the writing was there for a long time, and obviously it had been noticed by other people. Was it just considered graffiti or junk or something?
I think that's what people considered. They didn't realize the historic impact or understand why it was there. And if it weren't for Alexander Weiss, the building would have been torn down long ago. And scholars have looked at the poems and said they were, many of them are in a classically oriented style, and they've got all kinds of literary references, and people have copied them all down. We were lucky because there were two detainees who were in the immigration station for so long that they wrote down all the poems that they could find back then in the 20s and 30s, I believe, and they were made available to researchers like Judy Young and him, Mark Lai and Jenny Lim, and they published all these poems in a couple books, and because not all the poems are easily read. There's one poem in particular that somehow escaped the ravages of time, I think. Because the government would generally paint over naturally, right? They said, they're graffiti. We don't want them around. So they would cover them up with putty and paint over them. And what turned out is that over time, the putty would shrink and it kind of exposed the poems. So they were actually preserving the poetry for future generations and not realizing that.
Almost like literary fossils in a sense.
Yes. It's like, some headlines I've seen, if the walls could talk, and they definitely talk in these cases.
Wow. So when you mentioned literary references, so were some of these just recitations of other people's poems? Was some of it original, though?
I think they're all original, but they would make references to, like, things that happened 300 or 400 years ago or Chinese legends. And, you know, if I had made, I would snap Zhu's whip, which is some sort of military leader, I believe, who fought off, you know, invaders. You know, if I had that kind of power, I could do that. And so they were all pretty much originals. And scholars have some discussions on how they were created. Maybe there was a council to decide which ones were worthy enough to be carved, and then someone would write them by ink, and then they would be carved and by perhaps a different person, and whoever had the best handwriting or calligraphy, of course, would get to write them on the wall. And it's just amazing. That's an amazing place when you walk through.
I have a hard time believing detainees were allowed to have knives.
I know.
What are they use bed springs or something?
We think they look like knives. I mean, they weren't searched as much as the prisoners were who came there later, but I guess they figured they weren't going to harm anybody. But yeah, it is surprising that they had carving implements with them.
Truly.
Maybe they were passed on from detainee to detainee.
Grant Dinn is with the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation.